We set a precedent with this program that we're about to record, namely a second appearance by one of our first appearance participants, namely Victor Davis Hanson. The series has only been through some 25 to 28 separate recordings. And earlier we did talk with Victor about his book, The Savior Generals. Victor, today I want to talk with you quite directly about whether saviors are needed in the Middle East, all of which is ablaze one way or the other, as you well know. We are talking on the day when the West is still trying to decide whether to go into Syria in some minimal pinprick way or not. We won't know the decision on that either until later today or more likely a few days from now. Is the contemplated offshore assault with cruise missiles a reasonable undertaking, if it is indeed undertaken at all?
Well, I think it's going to be mostly to save face rather than to save lives at this point.
Yeah.
There were arguments to be made when Assad was just about to topple in the heyday of the Arab Spring 2 years ago, when the body count was low and he had not used weapons, but we kept walking away from the opportunity, and now I think there's no point in it because there's no objective, or at least there's no objective the president has stated. Is it to remove Assad? Is it to punish him for supposedly using WMD? Is it to help the rebels? If so, who are they, and are they better than Assad? None of those questions have been answered. They haven't even been asked.
So you say this is to save face if it's undertaken. By the time this is heard, we'll know whether it was or was not undertaken.
Yeah, I think even his supporters were flabbergasted when he made that one or two statements about a red line and he would do something.
Yeah.
Assad used chemical weapons. There's so much irony here because candidate Obama ran on the idea that it was illegal, and indeed his vice president said it was an impeachable offense to use military force against a sovereign nation without consulting or at least getting an authorization from Congress, which Bush did. Both in Afghanistan and Iraq. So we're not going to go to Congress. The peace, Nobel Peace Laureate's not going to go to the United Nations. And I don't think the Russians and the Chinese are going to get snookered this time. Last time they went for a no-fly zone and they ended up with bombing and close ground support, which was not authorized by the UN. So they're not on board. The British and the French, no more lead from behind. And there's not a good model in the Middle East for Obama to use. He got every single soldier out of Iraq, and he was quite happy, and that hasn't turned out well. And Libya ended up in Benghazi, and we flipped and flopped and flipped in Egypt and managed to have everybody dislike us. So I don't know what Afghanistan is, but he gave simultaneous surges and withdrawal dates, And as far as Iran goes, 5 deadlines now to Iran to cease and desist proliferation. So it's hard to see what model he's groping for. Maybe Serbia, but it doesn't. Serbia, at least, you had NATO involved.
So let's look at the problems that he faces, or that we or the West face, looking at the Middle East. And I propose that we do what the French call a tour d'horizon, a tour of the horizon, as we look at Syria, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Egypt, surely. But before any of that, I want to take you to a piece that I think you just had published yesterday up on the Internet, where you speak of the Israeli Spring. You say, I'm reading a quotation, "The more violent and chaotic the Middle East becomes, the more secure and exceptional Israel appears." Israel is profiting from all of this, even though people in Israel are chastising the government for not distributing gas masks fast enough and seem to be at some low level of panic. Is Israel really profiting?
I don't think they want to state that explicitly because it would seem to be enjoying mayhem and disaster, and they don't want to do that. But from a realpolitik point of view, Middle East authoritarians are killing Islamicists and vice versa. And the Middle East is showing that whether it is theocracy in Iran or via the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, or whether it's a military dictatorship under Mubarak or the latest junta that we have in Egypt, or whether it's militias in Libya or it's some type of tribal mayhem that's going on in Mali or the Sudan or Somalia, or whether it's just mountaineering tribalism in Afghanistan, the commonality is that you can't really deal with a government. It's not legitimate, it's not consensual, it's not constitutional. So when Israel tells us that Hamas and the Palestinian Authority are not legitimate interlocutors, that's more true than ever now. And I think people are going to wise up and say, my God, why are we reaching out to Turkey, or why are we reaching out to Muslim Brotherhood and trying to distance ourselves from Israel compared to what's been going on the last 2 years? Israel's an oasis of stability. So I think it does help the Israelis a lot. I understand what you're saying, that its borders are unsecure. They've replaced thuggish autocrats that kept their word about keeping the peace with who knows what. So it's a little bit more unsure. But Israel is not killing 100,000 Arabs. Arabs are killing Arabs. And Arabs are killing more Arabs than Israel killed in total from 1947 to 2006 in five or six wars.
So. Look directly into the domestic and economic life of Israel. I gather you see it as really a prospering state. And is it the case that they have now discovered oil, actually, in Israel?
Yeah, they have. They have discovered some natural gas and oil. How much we don't know, and to what degree they're willing to frack it and use horizontal drilling, we don't know, because they have the same Al Gore, John, Barack Obama resistance that we do. But should they fully exploit it?
Excuse me, Victor, I must interrupt you. Who is the Israeli Al Gore? What's the equivalent?
Well, I mean, in the sense of a left, a anti-development, green, radical environmentalist left. And that could hold up things. But my point is that the Israelis, unlike the Kuwaitis or the people in Qatar or the Dubai immigrants and those people, they have a real economy. It's growing at about 3 to 5%. It's based on high-tech manufacturing, precision manufacturing. And that's unusual in the Middle East. So if they should be an oil or gas exporters, specifically to Europe, they would have not only foreign exchange and increased clout and take the pressure off a little bit of Europe's unsecured sources of gas and oil, but they would have, it would complement their already robust economy. And you can really see that that would change their geopolitical outlook a lot. And I think people would, I don't believe that people have much of an ideology either way as far as the Middle East goes. They just react to power and wealth and influence and prestige. And I think the Europeans would probably gradually move toward Israel if they were buying Israeli gas and oil.
They might ultimately pass the Israel test. That, of course, was the title of the book by George Gilder about four or so years ago, in which he deals already with the economic success and prosperity of Israel, and says it's because they've got a functioning democracy and established political institutions, and they've got a fair amount of talent and considerable capital invested now in Israel. And it, he said 4 years ago, whenever that was, is flourishing and will be and is the leading state in terms of the success of a state in all of the Middle East. And he thought that a test for the West was whether that was properly appreciated and whether the nasty anti-Zionist routines would finally be put aside so that one no longer tried to placate angry Arab powers by echoing and resonating to their anti-Zionism.
Yeah, and I think that the argument that John Kerry is making is ossified, calcified, that the Middle East peace process is essential to greater Middle East stability. Israel has nothing to do with the Coptics being butchered in Egypt, has nothing to do with the use of sarin gas in Syria, has nothing to do with what happened at our embassy. Even the militants and the Islamists themselves and the dictators would say that they were not fighting Israelis or Zionists. So that was Israel's argument all along, that our particular border dispute with Palestinians is not at the heart of Middle East problems. There's wider things like tribalism, statism, authoritarianism, gender apartheid, anti-Semitism, racism. And you're blaming all of those things on us because you don't have the wherewithal or the desire or the resources to deal with that existential problem in the Middle East. And unfortunately, for the Arabs, the Arab winner, as I call it now, is sort of showing that to be valid, the Israeli argument. I think so in every way we look at it, just by sheer contrast, Israel is the beneficiary of this derailed Arab Spring.
You know, I was so eager to get right down to it with you that I did not do a full introduction, though I imagine you don't need much of an introduction, particularly for those who are listening to us on the web at the moment. However, just to touch proper bases, Victor Davis Hanson, of course, is a very well-known conservative advocate and a very important scholar, both of classical antiquity and of military history, and the author of many books, the last one being the Savior Generals, which I made mention of before. At the moment, Victor, you are just installed for your annual stay at the college in Michigan.
Yes, I'm at Hillsdale College. I come here on my vacation for 4 weeks a year.
Now, let me get back to the tour of the horizon that I was talking about. And let's go directly to Egypt, in that it is still, after all, the most potent of all the Muslim states, some 80 to 90 million in population. And is it possible that something will emerge out of the present military domination that might be a stable government? Or is that a deeply divided nation between Islamists and secularists, almost equally numbered, so that you can look forward to intense conflict on over the coming decades?
Well, I don't think the government's legitimate or constitutional, but it will be stable in the way that Mubarak was not constitutional or legitimate. It was a kleptocracy, but it was stable in the sense that the buses ran, the water came out of the tap. There was not a war with Israel.
Well, but then you expect that the military are going to hold on to power for the foreseeable future.
I do. I think they're going to try to at least keep power for two years or 3 years, and then uh-huh. The theory that the Muslim Brotherhood only achieved a minority and a plebiscite, they're going to try it again with a plebiscite and see that if this stability that they think they can achieve will rally people and they can vote in somebody that was an Arab nationalist rather than a Islamicist. So that's about the best we can hope for, I guess. I mean, there's not a lot of models in the Middle East. And for us to affect the course of events, we know how you have to do it. You have to go in and seek regime change, put troops on the ground, defeat and humiliate the enemy, serve as an occupation, literally put a gun to somebody's head and say, you're going to be a Democrat. And we did that in Iraq to great upheaval here at home and criticism abroad. It works, but the cost-benefit analysis is politically impossible now, so I don't think we'll see that again in our lifetime.
Why did our government tilt, to use a term that Henry Kissinger used a long time ago with regard to another situation, why did our government tilt towards the Muslim Brotherhood when they were established as government and then after they were displaced by the military? Why did we send McCain and I forget who else to kind of try to conciliate with the military and with General Sisi so as to restore the Muslim Brotherhood to the government?
There's lots of reasons, but I think philosophically there's a deep strain in post-Vietnam America that, especially among academics and politicians and journalists, that feel somehow that those abroad that are more anti-American or at least anti-Western de facto have more legitimacy, they're more authentic, and that people who like us and want to emulate our freedom or they're pro-Western, somehow they're suspect. They're not genuine. So whether it's Mr. Morsi that they seem to be attracted to in Egypt, but this, we saw the same thing in Iran when we had an election. We had genuine dissidents. They were pro-Western. They were even pro-American. And Obama passed them by and sort of de facto, again, tilted toward Ahmadinejad on the theory that only a sensitive, sophisticated, transracial progressive, multicultural thinking sophisticate like Obama could deal with Ahmadinejad, and that anybody who would replace him and be pro-American were suspect. I think that's sort of a product of the American university system among our elites. So when we see these characters abroad that spout this anti-Americanism, and they favor European socialism, they're authentically, religiously Islamicists. This administration and Obama, they tend to think, wow, these people are A, legitimate, B, they represent the aspirations of their people, and C, only a sophisticated person like myself, unlike a Texas twangy George Bush, can understand how to communicate with them. Because they sympathize with a lot of their critiques against the West. That's a small matter,
and this is sort of gossipy, but at the same time it's relevant. Huma Abedin, if that's the way you say her name, the wife of the at least discredited former congressman Wiener, now aspiring, but not with any success, to be mayor of New York. She was, of course, a close associate of and assistant to Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. It turns out that she, Ms. Abedin, has parents, both of whom, I think the father is now gone, but the mother is very closely associated with the Muslim Brotherhood and has run a related organization with and for them. Was there some sort of influence from the State Department pushing in the direction of serving and reinforcing the Brotherhood itself?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people in the State Department. I mean, that's always been the complaint against it, that it's an Arabist State Department.
Yeah.
That it brings people out of graduate school that are people of the left, and that manifests itself in the Middle East by being sort of anti-Western and pro-Arab. But I think it's just a general sense that in our multicultural value system, that if you have an exotic name or you can claim some genealogy or some cachet that's visibly and transparently anti-Western or different than America, then you get exemption. So in her case, she had an exotic name. She said she was of Middle East background. And then we said, wow, she's not a Tammy Wynette stand-by-your-man fool married to a creep who's a serial pervert who also did business on the side, cashing in through influence peddling with her boss. All of that would have been applied to anybody but her. So in the domestic manifestation of our Middle East policy, it butts up to multiculturalism. And Obama's a past master at that.
You had an interesting column just a little while ago examining the satiricon of Petronius Arbiter as it might have been recast and reenacted in the present day. And, of course, Congressman Wiener has a role in that cast. Who are some of the others that are?
Elliot Spitzer and Mr. Filner, the mayor of San Diego.
Yeah.
And, of course, now.
So these are all the sexual psychopaths in our politics.
Yeah. Look at Miley Cyrus.
She's not running for any office as far as I know.
Yeah. But it's part of the popular culture that it's kind of reached rock bottom, or as they say, jumped the shark, and it doesn't quite, it's becoming a parody of itself. There's no way, once you've had a rebellion, there's no way to rebel against the rebellion.
Let me take you in the tour of the horizon to Iraq and in relation to Iraq, Iran. Iraq seems to me a place where no final victory has been achieved and no stable government has been put in place. In fact, the Shia are being regularly murdered in their mosques by the Sunni, and there are some retaliatory explosions in Sunni mosques as well. But every weekend, there's another tally of 30 to 50 or 60 deaths by bombing.
When David Petraeus stepped down, there were two people killed, in Americans killed that month. And in the first months of Barack Obama's presidency, there were zero Americans. There were fewer being killed there than through accidents on a daily basis. It wouldn't have been hard to negotiate a status of force agreement where we might have had 5,000 people, say, in Balad with an air force and special forces, which would have denied Iranian airspace or given confidence to the new Iraqi air force, or in general put pressure on the Maliki government not to punish the Sunni majority and then to earn these types of reprisals that you're talking about. But we didn't do that. In fact, it was a campaign talking point that there wasn't one Iraqi, there wasn't one American soldier left in Iraq, but I think that was unwise. Especially, and then we heard that, you know, Afghanistan, we took the ball, we took our eye off the ball, and that was a good war, and Iraq was a bad war. And never in his right mind did Barack Obama, and by here I mean candidate Obama, believe that by the time he got into office, Iraq would be the good war that was quiet, and Afghanistan would be the bad war that wasn't. So he found himself, just as in the case of Syria, he was a prisoner of his own rhetoric, because he said he was going to escalate in Afghanistan and win it, and it was a proper war, and then he didn't really do it in the sense that his surges were coupled with withdrawal dates. He doesn't pay any attention to it. If an American is killed there tonight or tomorrow, or there's an attack, this administration is not interested in it. He doesn't address the nation about this ongoing war. So that was pretty much a disaster. More people have been killed in Obama's 5 years in Afghanistan than all seven of Bush's. So that is, like we said, it's not a model for anything, and it just reminds us that it's very, very dangerous for a president to issue deadlines or withdraw dates or red lines or this rhetorical chest thumping, spiking the ball, as he did with Osama bin Laden's death, and then not follow through.
Victor, let me run the risk of offending an old friend, though you can well assume that what I'm about to say is necessary role-playing. But still, could one not at this point argue that a kind of neo-isolationism may be called for? Why plunge into the cauldron of the Middle East, where everything goes not according to plan and where everything turns violent? How is our national interest in any serious way served by our trying to, quote, democratize the Middle East?
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. I supported the Iraq war after 9/11 because in a post-9/11 climate, the no-fly zones were not working, the oil for food program was leaky, and there was a good chance that Saddam would once again recycle his oil revenues into weapons and then do certain things. But after that occupation, I think it was clear to most Americans and most conservatives who was very lonely supporting that war, because most conservatives who had wanted it much earlier than I did flipped. Reminded me of what Matthew Ridgway said, the only thing worse than fighting a bad war is losing it. But I think after Iraq, people started to see that in a tribalized society in the Middle East, there's not a lot the United States can do without an enormous expenditure and investment in blood and treasure, and that the American people, for a variety of good and bad reasons, are not willing to pay that price. And therefore, if you're not willing to do that, you might as well keep out of it. And in Syria today, if radical Islamists have hijacked that revolutionary insurgency, and I think they have, and the way it happened in Iran and Egypt and Libya, then I don't see why you would want to intervene when our enemies are fighting our enemies in the way that Iran was fighting Iraq. It doesn't mean that you want the carnage to continue. You could always give food and aid and set up refugee camps and do what you could in the humanitarian sense. But when John McCain or Barack Obama said they're going to do something, they never tell us what is the objective, what are the means to achieve it, and what are the results that you want when you're done? And is the cost worth the benefit that will accrue?
How do you read the decisional hesitations or confusions of the president? How do you account for those hesitations or for those conflicts?
Two things. One is, I think that in his entire life, whether it was at Harvard Law or as a Chicago organizer or as a senator, he's been able to adopt a particular persona as a articulate, young, idealistic, post-racial man of the left. And he
could got him a Nobel Prize.
Yes. He'd say and do things that he was never held to be accountable. So he can give all these soaring hope and change speeches, and nobody really knew what they were about. He was a man who never was, and so it worked. And so I think that when he became president, he felt, if they're going to give me a Nobel Prize for nothing, or if I can get through Obamacare, through all of these things, I can just say anything I want, and it's going to happen. And, of course, it didn't happen. That's one thing. And then the second problem he's having is that he has a long rhetorical trail from 2008 onward where he made the argument that Bush did it. Bush did it. Not me. Bush did it. Bush did Guantanamo. Bush did renditions. Bush did tribunals. Bush did it, preventive detention. Bush did drones. Bush did Iraq. Bush did interventions. And there was never any notion of human frailty or human bad and worse choices. So when he got in office and held the reins of power, suddenly he found out that it wasn't so easy, that all of his caricatures and his Manichaean view of the world it's much more complex. And now he's got a problem because his left took him at his word that he was going to end Guantanamo, end renditions, end tribunals, not increase drone assassinations by a magnitude of 10. Which he has done, kill 4,000 people, anybody unfortunate enough to be in the same place as those who were blown up by Hellfire missiles. But nonetheless, that's the problem he has too right now. Barack Obama and what Barack Obama said and what he represents for millions of people does not go into the Middle East on questionable data about WMD, does not ignore Congress, does not ignore the UN, and does not bomb from the air. He just doesn't do that. There's nothing in his past or his support that would suggest he would ever do that. And yet that's precisely what we're just about ready to see happen. And I think that makes enormous political problems for him in the upcoming midterm elections as well. And I think it questions his legacy, questions his honesty, his integrity. And he's in a paradox. And then there's the other question is he cannot, because he doesn't know anything whatsoever about history or political science or war, he does not know that when you use military force, it has to be for an aim. You have to adopt a methodology that's proportionate to the aim, and you have to have a pre-planned result, an achievement, a desired result. He's never articulated that, because if he were to think about it, I think he would see there is no objective other than trying to regain some credibility that's been lost now. And then the problem is, his other dilemma is that because he's waited so long to carry out his threat, and because there's so little he can do to affect change in that area, that he's almost now, I think, with all certainty, is going to lob a day or two of cruise missiles. And that's already expected by Russia, by China, by Iran, by North Korea, by all the actors that are watching this. And it's not going to restore credibility at all. It's going to be sort of a Potemkin, you know, intervention. It's going to be something that they laugh at. And it means that he has to increase the stakes the longer that he waits. Because, after all, we've seen this before with Jimmy Carter. He did the same thing rhetorically and actually, and we ended up with Russians in Afghanistan, communists in Nicaragua, Central America, the Shah removed, hostages in Tehran, China invading Vietnam, all on the premise the United States wouldn't act or couldn't act. We saw it in 98, 99 when bin Laden announced that we were weak and that all we could do was send a cruise missile while they attacked the embassy, East African embassies or the USS Cole, or they killed people, and we got 9/11. So I'm a little worried because I feel that there's always bad actors and they're always looking to see whether the world's policeman is up to it for another day. And they've come to the conclusion after 5 years that there's a lot of evidence that says if I were to send a missile over Japan or I were a Chinese frigate to go into Japanese you know, waters or send a jet into Japanese airspace. If I'm Turkey and I want to just sort of create a Turkish fly zone in the Aegean that's in Greek airspace, or any of these places, we can do that now because the U.S. is in a sequestered withdrawal and the president, the commander-in-chief, he'd rather play spades with Reggie Love and two staff members than sit at the console and watch the bin Laden raid. Because
yeah, you just revealed that. in a recent column.
Reggie Love came out here to California and bragged that he had intimate knowledge of the president's habits, and that why we looked at the photo op of Obama glued to the console during the bin Laden raid. In fact, Obama asked him, Reggie, the bag man, and two staffers to go down into the basement and play a game of spades, not just a game, 15 games. That's a pretty detailed number. And then Obama said, I have better things to do than to go up and watch that. And he announced that. And so it was widely reported. And I just think he'd rather be in the back nine. He's a person who's not interested in foreign affairs, and he says and does things that the chickens, to quote Reverend Wright, the chickens are coming home to roost, because when you tell on an open mic, Mr. Medvedev, that after the election you'll be more flexible with Vladimir, and you simultaneously insult him and say that he's like a child in a schoolroom that's restless, which Obama did, then you've got the worst and abusive. And I really think that there's going to be a reckoning, and we're going to have to restore deterrence, and that's going to be difficult.
A song has just come to my mind from many years ago, as recorded by Peggy Lee, Is That All There Is? Which she sings about how disappointing life is. Is that all there is the recurring phrase. Is it conceivable, and I'm turning to individual psychological speculation, is it possible in your mind that that's his feeling about the presidency itself, that in some ways it's disappointing or a burden, or somehow it has turned to ashes in his hands, that he thought he had power for all sorts of good, but in fact his power is extremely limited and usually backfires, or often backfires, at least in foreign policy. Is it possible that he's humming, is that all there is, to himself?
I think the presidency was always a means to an end.
To what end?
The end was constant adulation, celebration, headlines, narcissistic attention. And the actual mechanics of being a president, whether Obamacare, where he used coercive methods to pass it without a single Republican vote, the Cornhusker, all of these terms we use, the Louisiana Purchase, to suggest that he was almost bribing his opponents to enact it. Nobody read it. Thousands of pages, nobody knows what's in it. Now it's a disaster, and he's lost interest in it. Same thing with the debt. The only degree to which he's financially responsible is because he had a sequestration imposed on him. The Middle East, and indeed the foreign policy in general, is not working well. And I just don't think that he's too worried about it, because I think in his way of thinking, I have 40% of the electorate that will never withhold their support from me, because I have so vastly expanded the federal workforce, food stamps, health care, disability insurance. They're essentially wards of the state. We haven't seen quite that number before. And then he also feels that if there's some diminution in American power abroad, it's analogous to the 1% at home. Just like there's the 1% who are culpable for having too much, and the 99% have legitimate complaints against them, pre-Obama America was the 1% abroad, and various parties had legitimate complaints against them. They were racist, they were colonialists, they were imperialist. And so if we're taking down a few notches, this is sort of spreading the wealth, so to speak, on a global sense.
Well, now look, you are not an official of the Democratic Party, nor of the Republican Party, but let's give some direct advice to the Republicans. That's where the opposition is. We've still got 3 years of this presidency. What can be done, what should be done by activist political people who are concerned about where this presidency has taken us.
Well, the most important event in the next 3 years, of course, is the 2014 elections. And should the Republicans win the Senate, then for all practical purposes, the Obama presidency is over as far as legislative achievement. But we will see more of what he's trying to do now, that is create law by executive fiat. And I think you'll see more and more of that through out of the mainstream appointments and things like just arbitrarily announcing that the employer mandate is not in effect anymore. So, or that for purposes of taxes, the IRS can legalize throughout the country gay marriage. So I think you're going to see a lot of that. What can the Republicans do about it?
They seem to be doing virtually nothing presently.
No, they're not. They're doing virtually nothing because they are afraid that demographically or culturally or socially, the country is moving in a direction away from traditional values, which have been successfully and brilliantly branded as somehow sexist or racist, war on women, war on Latinos, war on blacks, Trayvon Martin. And no sooner do they try to explain the latest charge against them is not true, then another one's leveled. So the Republicans, let's face it, when Eliot Spitzer and Anthony Weiner and Bob Filner have serially humiliated women through young prostitution, from texting your genitalia or to groping and grabbing women as a mayor of San Diego, and still the Republicans are the party of a war on women because some affluent woman like Sandra Fluke can't get free birth control pills, then they have a public relations problem. And the same thing with Latinos. If you can have 12 million people break the law and just walk across the border and then say it's racist to hold them accountable to federal statute, and that's all the Manichaean choices there are, and the Republicans have to fawn after the Latino vote in response to the war on Latinos. And then Trayvon Martin brought up the latest. They have to get out in front and reestablish the vocabulary and the terms of battle and try to not be offended. They have to be a lot stronger. They have to be a lot more unapologetic. And they have to remind the American people of how much we owe and what are the dangers of turning us into a nation of factions.
But aren't they, that is the Republicans, particularly the official Republicans in government, House and Senate, aren't they sort of split down the middle? Or
they
maybe
are.
It's a 60-40 split, with 60% saying we can't make waves, we can't allow ourselves to be accused of being racists or anti-gay or anything. We have to play this game their way. 40% are champing at the bit and saying let's call things what they really are, and let's resist this way.
Yeah, I think what we're at now is that the Beltway establishment, Republican Senate and House leadership for the most part, and the senior media grandees and the senior political operatives and analysts
are in the they are all in the don't make waves category.
Exactly, and then they're opposed by half the party wants to make waves.
Yeah.
And the problem with it is that the half that want to make waves are saying to those that don't, given everything you've gotten the last two elections, we nominated what you wanted. Nobody was more liberal in the Republican Party than John McCain.
Mm-hmm.
Mitt Romney had been a liberal governor, in fact, in Massachusetts. We've done that. We played your game, and we still lose. So let's take a chance. We're not going to say we're going to nominate Barry Goldwater, but let's take a chance on people who have genuine views that are unapologetic, and let's wage a cultural war in the manner that Republicans like Reagan had before, and may the best man win. And that's where we are right now. I think that the insurgent Republicans are starting to gain traction, but we'll see. And the Lindsey Grahams of the world are lecturing them and saying, we have more Latinos, we have more blacks, we have more young women, we have more gays than we've ever had. And when you add them all up, you guys don't have the numbers.
Yeah.
It's a different.
And I'm sure that Boehner is thinking in the very same terms.
So that's where we are. And the Tea Party people, I think, are not naive. They understand that, but they're trying to make the argument, sometimes not very well, that just because you're gay or black or brown or a young woman doesn't mean you can't be classically conservative as far as the issues that really matter. You don't want your kid in a unionized, bankrupt school district. You don't really want to be in a country that owes $17 trillion. You don't want to have to work at Starbucks every day while somebody is on phony disability. So that's their argument. It just they haven't found a voice quite yet. They've tried Marco Rubio. They've tried Ted Cruz, Rand Paul. But they also are plagued that there are a little bit of lunatic fringes in that grassroots Republican past, and they have to be careful about them.
Victor, I've known you for a long time, and I read you and talk with you always with absolute delight at the clarity that you bring to things, and with gratitude. I must tell you what I think I discerned today, that is that you view all of this as a rather depressing scene, and maybe your own ultimate belief in the triumph of virtue and good is faltering. You sound to me a little bit situationally depressed. I'm not talking about personal matters. I'm talking about political matters.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of history is farce right now.
Uh-huh.
We had a letter from the Birmingham jail by Martin Luther King as transmogrified into Oprah's psychodrama about a $38,000 purse in Switzerland.
Yes.
Our blacks that used to be beat by Bull Connor are now suing for cruel and inhuman punishment because they didn't get sufficient finalist in American Idol. And the whole culture has never been more affluent, never been more leisured, and never been more victimized. So I think that what we're looking historically at is a body politic that has so many grievances lodged against it that are so unsubstantiated that it doesn't have any supporters. When the president said that it's only exceptional the way Greece is exceptional, or when you have 12 million people risking their lives to come across the border and their leadership says immediately when you cross the border you have a claim against the United States because you haven't achieved parity with the existing population. It's fantastic. It's surreal. And it's hard to know. It's hard to know where we're going to go. We're kind of like the Weimar Republic, and we don't want some right-wing revolutionary like a Hitler to come in. So we're trying to find moderate figures that can correct this decline. But it's a decline of the military, of the finance, of the politics, of the general culture. And it's worrisome to be alive in it. I mean, I get up every morning and I ask myself, I'm on the 99 freeway. Is this better than it was 40 years ago when there was one third of the population? No, it's much worse. Are taxes higher or lower? No, they're much higher. I go by this local school, I point to it, and I said, when I was at that school, it was rated, the California schools were 11th in the nation. Is it better or worse? No, they're 49th. Are we spending more or less money? Vastly more money. And I think we can apply that logic to the United States. A lot of people are saying, am I going to be able to retire when my parents did? Am I going to be able to get a job when my parents did? Am I going to have real income and options that my parents had? And I don't see that. I see an elite, a left-wing and right-wing elite that are not productive and have controlled the discourse in the United States, and they're completely out of touch. So you've got a president that his family and he jet between Aspen and Vail and Costa del Sol and Martha's Vineyard and has Jay-Z, and then he talks about revolutionary social change, where I guess he's shaking down campaign contributors. Or you've got John Kerry talking about fairness, where he docks his yacht in Rhode Island to escape Massachusetts taxes. So we don't have iconic figures, I guess, on either side, and we need that, and maybe we'll get them soon. And maybe it will be all right. If we decide to go into Syria, I'm sure you and I will be the biggest supporters of it as Americans. We'll have to be, even though we understand that it's not really to do anything other than to restore Barack Obama's credibility. But that,
I should make a few things clear to our listeners or our downloaders. This conversation is being recorded on August 30th, and the decision to throw missiles at Syria has not yet been taken, or if it's been taken, it has not yet been enacted. And, of course, England is now backing away, and the French backed away, and so on. When this is heard, that drama will have been completed one way or the other. But the overall picture that you've developed today, Victor, doesn't hang on whether we are successful in discomforting President Assad or not. It hangs on deeper structural problems and deeper, I would have to say, because I really believe this, deeper problems in the dysfunctionality of religion itself. I have in mind Islamic extremism. I have in mind Salafism and so on. We live in difficult times, and that isn't necessarily very consoling. But you do wonderfully well in painting the picture as it is. You tell it like it is, and I'm very much in your debt for doing so. Through all of your columns, which are regularly published, through your many fine books, and through your appearances on media, and particularly with us. So, Victor, enjoy yourself over at the college in Michigan for a while, and we'll talk again soon, I hope, and thank you ever so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Righto. See you soon.
Okay.